Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters for Thursday, May 7th. Arden Zwelling here with Ben Nicholson-Smith. Ben, how are things on your side of the internet?
Things are good. Yeah, things are good over here. You know, not a whole lot new to report since we last spoke, but getting out for some runs, which is great, especially when you're inside for most of the day. I kind of appreciate probably more than I normally would the chance to get outside, even if it's just a couple kilometers, let off a bit of steam, get a little bit of exercise in. So that's been nice, occupying a bit of my time, but mostly the status quo over here. How about you?
Things are good. We're going to be joined by Shai Davidi momentarily to talk all things baseball and to talk about when we might see baseball again and hear what he's up to. Ben, I was going to ask you, you know, off the top for your quarantine update or for, you know, this week's tip, this week's advice, this week's interest. Is it running for you or do you have something else?
That's pretty much it. I mean, I find, you know, mixing up the duration of the run has been great because, you know, there's a temptation sometimes to go out there and, you know, just really, really get after it for a long run. But I've been mixing in some shorter ones, just creating that variation. I think it keeps your body guessing a little bit as opposed to knowing every time, all right, it's 5K or it's 10K. Mixing in some really short ones where you kind of push yourself a little bit harder. So I've been enjoying that. But, you know, otherwise, as I've said before, I'm more in the tip seeking business than I am the tip distribution business.
So what's a short run for you? Like you're talking like 2-3K?
My shortest runs that I would do would be just a mile.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And so are you going for a time?
Yeah, I basically try to do it as quickly as I possibly can.
So what's a good mile for you?
It would be around 6 minutes, which is, ooh. Yeah. So that's
good.
Yeah. So those are the good days. And
that's giving her. So what are they going to do about marathons this year? Like, what are they going to do about Scotiabank and stuff?
I think they're going to have to cancel them. I was signed up for the Yonge Street 10K. The Sporting Life, which is an amazing run. It's downhill, just a great, great chance to run down Yonge Street and see all kinds of parts of Toronto that are normally so busy. And then it's so quiet because there's no traffic. You can just take it in. Probably not unlike Yonge Street normally these days. But yeah, it's a great run. And they basically made it virtual. So, you know, for people who signed up like myself, then you run it virtually, you submit your own time, and it's basically honor system. I assume that's how it's going to work. I don't think that we're going to have any races in the near future. And that's, you know, on the list of things that we'll miss about society, it's probably pretty low, but those are always fun days if you get the chance to sign up for one and enjoy, you know, a nice run through the city.
So you're going to go and run that outside on the actual course, or are you going to run that like on a treadmill?
You run it wherever.
Okay, so you just run 10K anyway.
Yes, exactly. There's no specific spot you have to go, obviously limiting on, you know, Ubers or TTC or driving. Like it's basically you just step outside and run.
Because the appeal of that race is that it's downhill. You can't really recreate those conditions.
No, exactly. There's no recreating it. And I think too, like for me, part of the appeal of the race is there's a real adrenaline edge that you get out of it. I think that there's, you know, I'm sure there have been tons of studies on this, but you get a real boost in adrenaline if you're running alongside people, and you're far less likely, you know, to kind of slow your pace without realizing it. So to me, like that's part of the fun is if you're running along with people or you're running behind, you're always looking at people who by definition are faster than you, right? So the people who are ahead of you that are in your field of vision are booking it. They're going much faster than you. And that kind of provides a bit of a motivation.
So when I ran that race, like it was more of an annoyance for me because I think I put myself in the wrong starting block because I felt like I spent the first like quarter to a half of it just weaving around people. I was so frustrated. I think I needed to put myself in a faster starting block. You know what I mean?
Exactly. I mean, by the time you got up to speed, you'd probably done a full kilometer of lateral running, right? And like, and that's not going to count toward your time. Like, and it's just also the frustration, and you don't want to be a jerk who's, you know, elbowing people out of the way and in racing past everyone. So you got to get into the right, what do they call it? Cohort or color?
Yeah, I forget what they call it. I think I went one above where I should have gone. I did with like a bunch of guys and girls from my rugby team, and it was like we had no idea what we were doing, right? So like I think I did 44 minutes or something like
that's
that.
That's great,
like,
yeah.
I think I could do better though if I hadn't, like I think I ran 11K because I spent that 1K weaving.
Absolutely. I think that's a relatively common experience because it's hard to know exactly where to place yourself. And I think a lot of people have that same approach where they think, all right, I'll see where I finish. You don't want to oversell yourself. And then all of a sudden it's downhill. You get the adrenaline going and you do a little better than you thought.
Yeah, for sure. So do you want to know what I'm into now?
Let's hear it.
So last weekend, like, this is how starved for sports I was. I happened to come across an article that suggested that this gentleman by the name of Hofpor Julius Bjornsson, do you know who that is?
I have no idea.
You might know him as the man who played the Mountain on Game of Thrones.
Oh, interesting.
A smaller segment of our audience who is into strongman might know him as like one of the greatest strength athletes of all time.
Right. I saw a clip of him deadlifting something.
Yeah. So I came across that he was going to attempt this deadlift, the world record 501 kilo deadlift, more than anyone has ever deadlifted before, ever. I watched like the entire broadcast. It was like an hour long thing at his gym in Iceland, which is a whole can of worms we can get into in a minute. But like they had a whole like setup with lights and cameras. There was like a commentator there. They had an analyst on over Zoom and they're breaking everything down. They had sold advertisements for this thing. I guess ESPN broadcasted it. And the ads were like the most hilariously like bro-y aggro ads of all time for like exactly the people who you would expect to be watching a deadlifting, not even a competition, really, just like a guy deadlifting on ESPN. But I watched this whole thing. I got a good little jolt out of it because I was like, wow, like this is actually real. There's real stakes here. Like this is somebody who's actually doing something. I haven't watched a live sport in so long. And I think I'm a strongman guy now. Like I think I'm into it. I've fallen into it a little bit and I've learned about Brian Shaw. He's retired now, I believe, but like he won like World's Strongest Man like year after year after year. He's got a YouTube channel where he is like filming himself doing all kinds of crazy workouts and all kinds of crazy like eating regimens, by the way. Eddie Hall, who's a Brit, who had the previous record for the deadlift at 500 kilos. And Thor, the Mountain for Game of Thrones, they call him Thor. He's done 501 now. But there's a lot of controversy there because Eddie Hall did his in competition, whereas Thor did his just in his gym. And this is referred to, Ben, as a gym lift. You know, there's a lot of controversy as to, you know, was everything, were the plates standard? You know, he had his guys weighing them, like he had his people kind of fishing everything. Everything was very controlled. Everything was very like, you know, he knew at what times he was going to be lifting and he's able to, you know, plan everything out. Like, remember when I'm blanking on his name, but that guy ran the sub 2 hour marathon and he ran it and he had like these perfect teams of pacers and he had the car in front of him that was projecting out, you know, that kind of like laser beam for him to keep up with. And he ran, you know, in these super shoes on like the perfect day for running on the perfect course. And he set this world record and everyone was like, yeah, well, you know, do that in a real marathon. Like, it's kind of the same thing where he hit the 501 deadlift, but he did it in his gym under perfect circumstances. He didn't do it actually in a competition. So there is some controversy there, but still the man lifted 1,100 pounds off the floor. I'm into strongman now.
1,100 pounds.
1,100.
That's incredible. Like, that's just so much. It's, to me, like, I actually can't fathom what that would be like. Like, it's
that's a horse, you know?
Yeah, a horse. That's a good way to put it. So basically lifting a horse off the ground. That's incredible. So what's the draw besides watching the 5 second clip, which I think I saw on Twitter or something?
Yeah.
What's the draw of the full experience? Like, what's the draw of the sport beyond that quick highlight where you see the guy do it?
I guess, like, if I'm being totally honest, there's a bit of a freak show aspect to it, right? Like, so this man is 6'9", 450 pounds. And like, no man should be that size, you know, like you'd have to be, right? What's actually kind of incredible is that Eddie Hall, who had said it before him, is like a much stouter man. Like, I think he was probably also, you know, close to 400 pounds, if not above 400 pounds when he lifted 500 kilos. But he's like, I think he's only like 6'2" or something, right? So, you know, look, if you're 6'9", 450, you'd imagine you could lift some stuff. And also, it should be mentioned, like, I would imagine on just every performance-enhancing supplement under the sun.
Yeah.
Right?
I was going to ask. So there's no testing. They just take everything.
Yeah. I think it's just understood that just everybody is on everything, but which creates its own kind of fun level playing field, right? And also, you know, look, if you or I took every steroid on the planet, we couldn't lift 600 pounds, right?
Like, no chance.
We couldn't lift half what this guy lifted. So there is still like an element of, you know, the just he has been naturally selected to do this. You start looking into, because all these guys have really active YouTube channels, which is great because you can look into all their training and you can watch them for 20 minutes go into like commercial gyms and just like mess everything up. And they're like loading massive plates on bars and stuff. And you can just kind of see the process. The eating videos are like fascinating because these guys are eating like 10,000, 12,000 calories a day. Like just to maintain that mass. Think about maintaining 450 pounds and a lot of it's muscle. And you're also spending like 4 or 5 hours all day like training. These guys just sit down and like, it was Brian Shaw who said it. He said like, the training is the easy part. The eating is the work. Like that's when I'm having to like shovel down like 12 eggs for breakfast. And then an hour later, I've got to have like 5 cups of rice and like 4 chicken breasts. Like, and I've got to eat all day long. That's the way he put it, is that the eating is actually the work. So just kind of like getting a look into what the life is like of a strongman has been fascinating for me.
Man, I remember when Michael Phelps was in the Olympics and there was all that focus on his diet and how much he ate. Now, I remember at the time being, I guess this would have been 2008, and I was just totally in awe of the fact that he ate as many calories as he did, which might have been around 8,000 if I remember. I might be off on that. But this is, you know, 10,000, 12,000, that's 6 times your standard adult diet in the course of one day. So for every one meal that you or I might be eating, they're having 6 meals that would be constant eating.
Yeah, and they're not, you know, eating fun food either. They're eating like white rice and like ground beef and, you know, chicken breasts. Like you'll see them eat like half a cheesecake and that'll be like, yeah, I just needed to, you know, get my fat intake up today or my calories up. And this is just a quick way of doing it. Just the rigors of that life, I can't imagine. And now, so now that this record has been broken by Bjornsson, him and Eddie Hall, they actually have this feud, and I can't really figure out how much of it's manufactured and like how much of it's real, like how much of these guys really dislike each other or how much they're just kind of, you know, shooting these YouTube videos. They're going to get a bunch of clicks and make everybody rich, but they've actually signed a contract to box each other.
Oh, wow.
So you're going to have 6'9", 450 pound guy boxing a, 6'2", you know, whatever Eddie Hall is now, 350, 360 pound guy. Like, I'm sure they're going to cut a bunch of weight in order to do this, but they also have to keep their weight up in order to compete in the strongman. So there's going to be an interesting kind of push pull there, but there might be this like freak show boxing match at some point between these like insane strongmen. And I am along for the ride.
Wow. I mean, the reach alone on the 6'9 guy would seem to give him a big advantage, right? Like, I don't know much about boxing, but if you can reach 6 inches further than the other guy, I mean, he's got to be favored to win.
You would think the smaller man might have a bit more gas and might be a bit faster, but I've actually seen some videos of Thor just kind of like moving around the gym. He's surprisingly agile for a 6'9" dude at 450 pounds. He moves really, really well. He is just a freak of nature, like just an unbelievable athlete. He's now lifted more weight off the floor than any man has ever lifted before. So good for him.
Do these guys make money from it? I mean, aside from the fame or the YouTube followers, like, is there a financial prize if they set this record?
I'm sure the majority of it comes from sponsorships. So like, I'm sure each one of them has a protein powder sponsorship, and I think they probably sell space on the gear that they wear during competitions and, you know, their wrist straps and everything and their belts and all of these things. And I'm sure that they'll, you know, promote anything that they're asked to. And I would bet that there's some prize money on the line at some of these competitions, but I actually don't know what the prize money is off the top of my head. Like, I don't know if they're, you know, getting super, super, super rich, but I think they're doing okay for themselves.
Let's hope so. If you're lifting 1,100 pounds, you should make a little bit of money for that. I mean, that's like just an insane, insane level of weightlifting.
Oh, yeah. It's dangerous, too. Like, straight up, like, even just to live as a person who is 450 pounds, even if a ton of it's muscle, it's a lot of stress on your heart. You know, it's a lot of stress on your arteries and just on your central nervous system and on everything. And then you think about the amount of force that is going through your body, through your heels and your knees and your ankles and your hips, as you are lifting 500 kilos off the ground. Like, there are like deadlift videos out there of guys lifting, you know, 400 kilos, 450 kilos that, you know, and they just start like vomiting and they start like bleeding out of their noses because there is so much force going through their bodies as they're pulling it up. Yeah, and which is what makes it even more impressive that Thor like made it look easy. Like there's a lot of people speculating that, you know, on the day he could have done 410, 420 if he had gone for it. The weight moved incredibly well. Whereas if you look at Eddie Hall's 500 pound lift, it's like pretty clear like this man is in a lot of discomfort. Not that Thor wasn't, but Thor made it look a lot easier.
Man. The things people do, it's like, and I guess it's really, you know, thinking back to our conversation about F1, is it any more sane to get behind the wheel of a car that's going 300 kilometers an hour and just race, you know, for all you're worth for an hour and a half? That's pretty crazy as well in a lot of ways, but this, like the deadlifting of that much weight is just next level.
Yes, yes it is. So that's my thing this week. We'll see what rabbit hole I go down next week. But we should get to Shy TV. We should get to Baseball Talk. It's a baseball podcast. So after this, we'll be joined by our colleague, our friend, Sportsnet's Shy Davidi. Shy Davidi's with us. Shy, thank you so much for taking the time. Very excited to have you on today to talk about a number of topics, but off the top, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you how things are going in quarantine. Ben and I have been regaling our listeners with our adventures with Formula One racing and gardening. But, you know, Ben and I, we get to kind of pursue these like frivolous adventures because we don't have kids and we're not parents. You are very much a parent. And I feel like having kids right now is like being in the big leagues of quarantine and of isolation. Whereas Ben and I are minor leaguers, like Shy, like you're in the show. So maybe you can kind of, you know, share with us what you've learned and how you've kind of preserved some semblance of sanity in this time.
Well, essentially, I feel like I've enrolled in hockey linesman school because I'm pretty good at breaking up fights at this point. I know how to get in there and just separate the guys before it gets out of hand. I'm not an NHL-style linesman where I'm just going to sit back and watch them go until they're tired. So I think that has been certainly a plus. You know, otherwise, it's been relatively busy. You know, the homeschooling does eat a bit into the day, but there's still been trickles of news, certainly not the kind of news that we'd like. So there's been a lot of stuff to do, a lot of stuff to chase. And as you guys know, everything's a little bit harder. But I've also found that I've become very proficient at snacking. I think what I've created over the course of this pandemic is a new class of procrastination that I call snackcrastination, whereby, you know, I raid the pantry as a way to avoid doing tasks I don't really want to do. I don't think that was particularly good. And I've learned that I need to work far away from the kitchen and the pantry in order to avoid snackcrastination.
That makes a ton of sense. I think for all of us, it's varying degrees of it, right? Like for me, I find that I can not only get pulled into, you know, snacking on whatever it is in the pantry. You got some nuts or some goldfish or some chips, but I'll take it to the next level and just make an elaborate snack that might take me 45 minutes. And then you have to clean up. And under normal circumstances, there's no way I'm doing that on a random Tuesday. But here we are. And that's something I find myself doing pretty often.
Yeah, I'm also finding that, you know, because it's such an ordeal to get groceries now that you have to really manage your food well. So I'm hyper aware of what's in my fridge and when it's going to start going bad. And so I've got like plans. And if I'm worried that something's about to start turning, then I'm like, I got to make a plan for this thing immediately right now. And sometimes it does turn elaborate. And, you know, I've been working. I haven't posted much stuff yet, but I've got a nice array of food pictures that I could post to Instagram if I need to suddenly become an Instagram foodie. It's interesting times. We're all making this up as we go along in different ways and doing whatever we need to do to survive.
Like the secret is keeping good snacks, right? So like you want to keep like almonds and like cut up veggies and I don't know, like seed crackers and things like that, rather than keeping, you know, like chips and like processed stuff and whatever. But then, you know, the other side of that is that it's still just calories in, calories out. Just because you have the good snacks, you end up eating that many more of them because you think, oh, this is healthy. Like, this is fine. It's okay if I crush like half a bag of almonds right now. Well, you know how many calories are in friggin' nuts? It's insane. Like the amount of calories that are in some of these healthy snacks. Sometimes I just feel like there's no winning, Shy.
No, there absolutely is not. And I've been running more than I have in quite a long time. You know, I've gotten up to 10K a few times and in and around that. And I feel I need to do that to just stay level right now. just to balance things out. But I also find as much as you try, even if you want the good snacks, I don't know, I just think that maybe to counter the depression of what the current situation is and all that, that sometimes, you know, I need me some chocolate raisins or something else that's junky just to kind of get you through the day a little bit, you know, give you that little bit of support to treat this as if it's normal. You know what I mean?
You never feel great after binging on a snack, but there's something familiar, if not a great feeling. It's a familiar feeling to go through a bag of, you know, let's say kettle chips. But if I'm binging my way through, you know, kale chips or seed chips, that's I've been there in the last few weeks, and it's just a weird feeling.
Right. It's like, kind of, what's the point, right? It's like, I know this isn't going to be good for me, so I might as well make myself happy. And if I'm going to like get a bunch of calories in my system, then I might as well make them calories that I enjoy as opposed to these calories that I sort of enjoy, but you know, maybe they're less guilty, but they don't give you the same amount of satisfaction in the end.
Well, the three of us have this massive void in our lives, and we're clearly trying to fill it with almonds and kale chips and chocolate covered raisins. And that is a baseball game every day, because for the last however many years for all of us, we have had that daily grind and that daily renewal of there's another game today and there's another game and there's another starting pitching matchup and there's another guy who is injured and we'll see if he's going on the IL and there's another minor league decision to be made and this, that, and the other. And we don't have that. And we just went through the first complete month of April without Major League Baseball in more than 100 years. It's wild. We are also starting to hear the gears of the game start whirring back together and starting seeing things moving towards a resumption of baseball. Perhaps the latest being that MLB is expected to table a proposal on return to play to the Players Association. This coming from people like Jess Passan and Ken Rosenthal and Joel Sherman, you know, that we could have that proposal, you know, as soon as the end of this week or early next week, sometime in the coming days. Shai, is this any different than the dozens of trial balloons that we have seen floated over the last several weeks, or is this more of the same?
No, this is something a little bit more concrete, because this is going to be an actual proposal with details, not just ideas with vague concepts of how they might work. Sounds like there's going to be an actual pitch to players saying, hey, this is what it's going to look like. And whether or not that's going to be tenable, I'm not sure. And look, there's still a lot of hurdles to clear, right? Just from a health standpoint, there are a lot of things that they have to figure out, you know, location, how they're going to pull this thing off. But Major League Baseball seems to be intent right now on opening in as many home cities as possible. They haven't ruled out the hub city or neutral combine type of setup yet, because, you know, the health realities may ultimately dictate that. But this is starting to get real. Are we going to get to the finish line? That's a whole other discussion. But what Major League Baseball is trying to do right now is clear as many hurdles as they can on the non-health front to ensure that once they can figure out all the dynamics of a return to play from a health standpoint, the other stuff isn't going to scuttle it.
And I think that makes sense, right? Like, you have to, just as you plan for the worst case scenario, you also have to plan for the best case scenario. And at this point, that probably looks like spring training at some point next month and a resumption of play, or I guess a start of play, at the beginning of July. So you consider that if everything breaks right, here's where we would line up. Now, Shai, you wrote about this on sportsnet.ca this week, and the Blue Jays are in a unique position, obviously, being the lone Canadian team. So from your understanding of where things stand, where do the Blue Jays stand as far as their plans to resume play or to start up play, and how, where essentially they would play, whether it's in Toronto, Dunedin, or somewhere else?
Sure. All right. So before we get into it, let's start with the caveat that there's still 2 months, or roughly, before any of this needs to be sort of definitively locked down. So there's a lot of runway and a lot of time for things to change, both positively and negatively. But as things stand right now, as long as the orders under the Quarantine Act related to border crossings are in place, as they are right now, you know, the Blue Jays can't play here, because their players would have to go into self-isolation for 14 days. the minute they landed. And any team visiting them would need to go into isolation for 14 days once they arrived. And then there would be the issues of getting back across the border afterwards. So, you know, that's simply not feasible. So the Blue Jays have been modeling scenarios in which they're able to play in Toronto and modeling scenarios in which they aren't able to play in Toronto. Logically, Dunedin, if everything in Florida is aligned, makes the most sense. You know, that's where they be, in theory, setting up for spring training. The players wouldn't have to move to multiple spots. They could just stay in that one spot. And then if you needed to, because the situation in Toronto improved or something related to the border ended up working out, then you could move games to Toronto in theory at some point during the season. You know, the schedule simply shifts from Dunedin to Toronto. But it's an issue that's on the horizon, but it's not the number one concern. You know, if you think about it more holistically, there are 30 teams in Major League Baseball and 29 are in the United States in 18 different states. And each one is going to have a different governor with different circumstances and different health regulations. And so coordinating all of this is super complex. So the Blue Jays aren't necessarily alone in this, you know, because California may say, hey, we're too far behind and doesn't matter that things are going great in New York, we're still lagging, or whatever the case may be, there's going to be a lot of disparity. The Blue Jays just have this added wrinkle, which while the current border rules are in place, is essentially making Toronto a no-go.
It's chaotic when you think about it with all the different regulations and rules across different jurisdictions. The Blue Jays, as you mentioned, are in their own sort of unique situation with this kind of interesting push-pull between Canada and the United States, where you look here in Canada, it seems we've done a much better job of containing the virus and mitigating it, while in the United States, it's just been a total gong show in that regard. But the flip side of that is that Canada might be a bit more cautious in reopening and a bit more thoughtful and deliberate in how it eases restrictions, where in some United States states, you know, we've seen them just kind of steamroll ahead without a whole lot of discretion. So how do you think that dichotomy kind of impacts how the Blue Jays could participate in an MLB plan to have teams playing at their home ballparks? Because you could foresee staging games in Toronto being easier because the virus has been better contained here, but also being more difficult because we're going to be slower to get to a point where you could have a few hundred people at Rogers Center to play a game.
Sure. You know, just to add to that, one of the pieces of guidance that Major League Baseball has gotten from health officials is that, you know, the more you contain and limit travel, the better off you're going to be. So Major League Baseball wants to try and be as contained as possible. And then you think about that from a Canadian perspective. Let's use Florida as an example. You know, Governor Ron DeSantis made those infamous comments about a week and a half ago. He was musing about the Marlins and the Rays playing games with fans in the stands right in June, July. There's certainly different standards. And, you know, Canada has been way more cautious. You know, the caution doesn't simply end within the country. It also extends to who you're letting in and out of the country. And so if you're going to have teams or athletes coming in from states where, you know, the caution isn't the same, you know, Florida, we're looking in your direction, then, you know, are you potentially creating more risk because the potential for exposure in Florida could, in theory, be higher than it would be in other spots? And does that govern some of the decisions that health officials are making? So, yeah, it's super complicated. And you'd like to see more areas in the United States acting with the same level of caution and responsibility. But that's a factor that we're not going to get. And it's going to be tough for Major League Baseball to find a way to equalize that across the board.
There's almost no way of doing it, really. And it's a matter that's in so many ways outside of the control of the individual teams. I mean, Major League Baseball as an entity has some say in this because it's a $10.7 billion industry and they have a lot of financial and political clout behind it. But team by team, you know, they almost have to just play the hand that they're dealt with respect to what the rules are in that state or province and, you know, what country when you're talking about the Blue Jays. But, you know, I'm considering, you know, as we look at all this and we look at the possibility of a season where the Blue Jays play but don't play in Toronto or don't play much in Toronto. I'm wondering what that's going to do for the relationship between the fans and the players in the city. It's one of those questions that nobody hopes to have to answer, and it's probably impossible to really predict. But you think about, you know, over the years you hear anecdotes of, oh, you know, I saw Marcus Stroman at Whatabagel, or, you know, my buddy is at that goes to the same pub as Mike Babcock. And it's kind of cool, you know, you feel like there's this connection between the players and the city itself, and that's going to disappear, at least for a small period of time. I'm wondering, Shai, like, how do you think that will impact the experience of watching the Toronto Blue Jays when the Toronto Blue Jays don't play in Toronto for a period of time?
Here's how I would throw it back to you. If the games are played with no fans in the stands, does it matter?
I say yes.
Really? I'm not sure it does. And here's kind of my thinking of it. Let's use a couple of the examples. Like, oh, you're seeing those people around and it's kind of cool. Are any of us going to be doing that in the next couple of months anyways? I think that the expectation that, you know, the government continues to lift regulations and everything goes back to normal, we're not seeing anything remotely near our old normal until there's a vaccine and until a lot of people have been vaccinated or there's a reliable antiviral, right? Until we get to that point, we're going to be living in this weird dystopian kind of existence where we're staying away from each other. We have to put in all these extra cautions and we're wearing masks and, you know, we're hand sanitizing every 3 seconds and gloves everywhere. And we're a long way from that world, right? And so if your only access points are going to be through TV anyways, or through, you know, hopefully reading stories that you've read on sportsnet.ca, if those are going to be your primary touch points, is it even relevant where they're playing? And I think people will just be happy to watch their team playing again. And if they have to be playing at their spring facility in Dunedin because of the current regulations that are in place, you know, I'm not sure that people are going to be terribly upset about it, because even if the Blue Jays win the World Series or the Raptors repeat as NBA champions or the Toronto Maple Leafs win the Stanley Cup, there's not going to be 2 million people in the streets like there were here last fall when the Raptors won it all. None of this is happening in that way. So I think that, you know, there's sort of the ideal of what things used to be, which is gone. And I think we're just going to have to adjust to whatever it is and try to make the most of what comes, because I mean, it's just going to be a long time before we get there.
100% Shai. I agree. I think that's those points are definitely well made. And you know, there's no going back, as you said. There's no way to restore what we're used to, especially in the short term, that, you know, eventually might happen. But to me, it would be a slight difference, you know, to most fans. There's such a familiarity with Toronto. And if you have the, you know, overhead shot panning to Rogers Center, you see the domes open. Maybe the stands are empty, but you see the domes open. They're there in Toronto, in your same country, in your same city. I think that would be a slight difference. Now, does that slight edge or advantage or boost to morale overturn the need for public health? Like, not even close. So I think absolutely Canadians would see that and very sensibly say, if it's safer to do it in Florida or Peoria or wherever, then that's totally fine.
Yeah. And the one thing that I could see is that if the Blue Jays were the only team not able to be at home, like the other 29 clubs are all home and only the Blue Jays are orphaned and kind of thrown into the wind, I could see that being a bit of a sticking point, right? But I don't think it's going to be only the Blue Jays, at least to start. I think that there's going to be a handful of clubs that are going to be in a tricky situation as well. But I don't know. I just think if you can't get there, I mean, does it really matter? I think you just want to see the games. I don't know, Arden, where are you on this? But I just don't see it really factoring.
I mean, the big question this raises to me is like how teams are going to, you know, tackle a scenario in which they can't bring in revenue from fans, in which they're not selling tickets, in which not selling merchandise, hot dogs, beers, parking, etc. Like I look at the process that the league and the players are going to have to go through in order to iron this return to play proposal out. And like, I do not see it being a brief one because there are so many issues like that, you know, beyond player and public safety and the welfare of everyone and their families and where everyone's going to be living and eating for months. But you think about how salaries and how contracts are going to be honored and what fair payments even look like in a world in which MLB teams are pulling revenues of zero, or in which you have this uneven playing field where certain teams are playing at home and certain players get to have that certainty of being in the city where they believe they were signing up to be in, and other players don't. You have to negotiate all those things and make it as fair and equitable as possible across a number of different teams in a number of different situations. And we haven't even gone into, you know, how service time is going to be awarded or bonuses, incentives, what expanded rosters could mean for player options and for service. I mean, Shai, like all the variables, they like it kind of makes my head spin.
Yeah. And, you know, just to go another level of all the things you just mentioned, all of that is happening against the backdrop of a collective bargaining agreement expiring at the end of the 2021 season, one that is largely reviled by players. And the landscape going into this pandemic was there is going to be a major conflict between players and owners over the next collective bargaining agreement. So it's certainly an unsettling environment. An interesting conversation I did have with someone in the game was that, and this was the perspective, that even if the owners have to take some sort of loss this year on playing, it still makes sense for them to play and to avoid being out of the public eye for a year, just because the longer you're away, the tougher it is going to be to re-engage your fans. And so to me, what's intriguing is if you don't have games that are local, how are you connecting? A big part of connecting with your fans is the experience of coming to the ballpark, right? And they get to see the players that they love up close, and they get to have conversations with them, and you feel like you're a part of something bigger when you're at the ballpark. That collective experience that you get by being at the stadium itself, as opposed to watching a TV or even watching at a bar, you can't replicate that for people. And that's, and a lot of times those experiences are the ones that are lasting with fans and keep that connectivity over the long term. What can you do to replicate that? And, you know, I think that's going to be a big part of the package when baseball returns. And Ben, I know this is a passion of yours. And, you know, I think that, that this is certainly something that's being talked about and explored thoroughly right now, is whether players are going to be mic'd up when they come back, other ways to create those engagements with the game. But the economic issues are real. And if Major League Baseball and the players let that get tripped up over that, and that becomes a major impediment to getting back on the field, then it's going to be shame on everybody, because this isn't the time for that fight.
Yeah, they've got to find a way to get something done. And I love the idea of having players mic'd up. I think, you know, there's so many ways to do it. There's so many people who impact a baseball game, whether it's a coach, potentially a trainer, you have the manager, you could mic up someone in the front office for a game if they were up for it. I mean, there are lots of ways to show just how much people care and how invested. People might be surprised. And we wrote about this last year when the Blue Jays were on their way to a 95 loss season. But man, you get down to field level and you see the intensity that even a 95 loss team brings every night. We'll sometimes be down there before a TV hit with Hazel or Arash, and you'll see the players start to trickle out. They are intent on bringing full intensity, full effort to that game. And so that's something that microphones could pick up on a broadcast. Now, the counterpoint to that, I don't know what you guys think about this, but for me personally, I grew up listening to a lot of games on the radio. And part of the experience of listening to a game on the radio is, you know, in my case, Tom Cheek, Jerry Howarth, sometimes they'll just chill. They'll just sit back for a minute. They'll let the crowd noise speak for itself. And, you know, that's, lots of broadcasters will do that as a way to bring fans in and let them experience the pace of the game. Now, if there's no crowd noise, like, is that just going to sound like really eerie? Is it just going to be silent, like dead silence on the radio? Or is it going to be one outfielder cursing and it comes over? Like, everything is going to be so different this year. But the fan experience of listening to, watching games, that's going to be really different too.
Yeah, imagine Jose Bautista on a pop-up.
Yeah. Well, you can hear that when there are fans in the stands. I agree that MLB needs to find a way to up the accessibility to the game, you know, if and when it does return, and if fans aren't allowed to go and have that ballpark experience, because Shai's right. Like, that's such a massive part
of the experience and of why, you know, you might tune in Monday to Friday at, you know, 7:07 because you know you got tickets for 1:07 on the weekend and you're following around along with this team and you're getting to know the players and then you're going to go see them live in person and know their tendencies and know how they react to things when you go watch them on the weekend. So, you know, without that, you need to find a way to bring fans into the game. Like, it's part of what makes spring training so great. Like, it's one of the rare times you get to be that close to the game. And like, of course, it's not the same level of competitiveness and of course, it's not the same intensity, but that's as close as you can actually get to what's happening on the field of plays at those small Florida State League ballparks. So I think that MLB needs to look at miking up players. I think they need to look at, you know, maybe some of those interviews that you see between, you know, like during the games that we see during spring training. I mean, maybe you see those during regular season games. I've advocated for like leaning into like going hard weird this year and like shuffling up divisions, running a World Baseball Classic style tournament, not awarding the World Series, like just having it be something totally different in and of itself, trying out some of the Atlantic League rules. Like, I think it's an opportunity here for baseball to get creative, to try some things, to do some exciting, new, innovative things that are going to pull people into the game and attract new fans and get people excited about baseball again. And the things that work, you can carry forward into 2021 when you would return to a normal, we assume, 162 game schedule and World Series. And things that don't work, then you don't carry them forward, but at least you found out.
Arden, you just gave baseball orthodoxy a heart attack with what you just... It's a great thought. Look, I think that a lot of the things that you say are right and would be great. I don't think that we're going to see a radical departure or as radical a departure as, you know, you described there. My guess is that they will make the accommodations that the health situation forces them to. But beyond that, they're going to try to keep it as true to what the game has been as possible. And, you know, whether or not that ends up engaging people in the same way, I think that there's some risk here between, you know, trying to change too much to try and get some new people involved and to just kind of say, hey, we've got a freebie, let's throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks, versus, you know, making sure that you're servicing the legions of fans that you have right now. And there's going to be so many issues. Even something as simple, like Ben, you were mentioning what we see when we're on the field before a game. And like, you think about when you see people getting an autograph, how much it means to them to get that interaction with the player. Like, that's gone. You know, when the Blue Jays put up the meshing around the stadium this year, or at least designed it, you know, they were very, very conscious of not cutting people off from getting autographs and trying to find ways to ensure that fans will still have the ability to connect with players and get that, get against the wall with a selfie with them and things like that. All that stuff is gone. Like, all those little subtle connections, the things that really resonate with people over long term, are gone. So can you really shake the game to the core, you know, the way that you're suggesting? And at what point does it start threatening to make a mockery of whatever season you're able to put together? So I love the idea of weird, you know, like early in the pandemic, I suggested, hey, let's just go to a NCAA style playoff tournament and see what happens. But, you know, the more that I'm thinking about it as this has gone along, I've started thinking that, you know, getting too weird can be dangerous too. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can see what you're saying there. I mean, there's one way or another, I think the point you made earlier about the need to be in the public eye is a really good one. Major League Baseball, maybe they experiment more, maybe they experiment less, but one way or another, they have to be there because, you know, we're all in the same boat right now. Everyone is, whether it's the Last Dance or whether it's something else on Netflix, we're all looking for different ways to be entertained right now. And the longer that Major League Baseball or any sporting league is absent, then the more ways people will find to fill their time. And there are plenty of compelling ways. You know, I'm sure that various, you know, shows are getting a boost in traffic. People, I'm sure, are spending tons of time on Instagram that they might not otherwise have been spending. It's a big adjustment on that front. But, you know, the Jays, in a lot of ways, might be positioned to handle this challenge of connecting with fans better than a lot of teams, because to begin with, their fan base stretches so far away from Toronto. And I mean, certain teams like the Yankees or Dodgers or Cubs or Braves, they have pretty wide-reaching fan bases too. But you really look at a coast-to-coast fan base for the Blue Jays, and they've done various things with fan fests and traveling tours. And all of that is designed to get the face-to-face interaction that now is likely to be changed, or it definitely will be changed forever. It might disappear in some cases. But, you know, if you want to look for a silver lining, the Jays are probably a franchise that are better equipped to handle this than, let's say, the Kansas City Royals.
One thing I think that's going to work for the Jays, too, is that, you know, they've got a young, emerging core, and a lot of them are media savvy, social media savvy. They're comfortable in the spotlight. And, you know, we'll see what happens when, you know, a few years of baseball performances and maybe riding the roller coaster a little bit, how that influences, you know, the progression. But they've got some good personalities for engaging a fan base. And I think that's a good element. So it gives you lots to work with. But the game has been moving this way towards social media, towards creative ways of engagement. But people still care about the old ways, right? People still want those personal engagements. I think you're right, Ben, that, you know, they might be gone, if not forever, at least for an extended period. The one thing that, you know, has happened over these 2 months is that a lot of patterns have been broken and a lot of new habits have been built. Nobody fully knows how different we're going to be when we emerge from this in every realm. And being a baseball fan is a commitment. Okay. Like, shout out baseball fans. Like, you guys grind for 162 days paying attention to something. You guys live it. You ride the roller coaster. Like, it is a commitment. Like, you can't be like casual about it. And good on baseball fans. But is it going to come back in the same way? Will people's priorities have changed? Well, some people's situations are definitely going to be changed. I don't know. It's like the whole world is going to be different. And to what extent, we don't know. And there was a good column that Andrew Coyne and the Globe and Mail put together pretty early into the pandemic. And he was sort of rolling his eyes at all the, you know, this is going to be changed forever predictions that so many people were making in so many different walks of life. But to me, what guarantees there are going to be some changes is the fact that we can't get back to full normalcy, at least until there's a vaccine. And that's going to be an extended period. And it's not like the second a vaccine's created that, hey, like, we've got a stockpile of 38 million needles and we've got all this product. Let's go get it. Like, it's going to be a process to just get Canada alone vaccinated, let alone the rest of the world. This is going to be a long time before we're fully back to normal and living the way we used to. So I would expect that we're going to be making accommodations and adjustments for a long while to come. And what we kind of look like by the time that's all over, you know, it's going to be in a lot of ways unrecognizable to the way we used to do things.
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting, you know, hearing you talk about, you know, baseball fans, like the true, like, diehard, hardcore baseball fans who are like up to date on, you know, the minor league players, like they know all the affiliates, like they're, you know, refreshing transaction websites and stuff. Like, every sport has those layers of fans, right? Like, every sport has its, like, diehards, and then, you know, it's kind of medium interest, and then it's kind of casuals, as you said. And we've seen in Toronto, when the Blue Jays are good, the casual fans come rushing in and the Rogers Center is packed and the bars are packed. Those aren't things that are going to be able to happen anymore if the Blue Jays are good again, or at least it's going to look very different, you know, in terms of distancing. But I think baseball might run up against a situation if they try to, you know, resume this summer or this fall, where other sports are starting to whir back to life as well. And there's going to be quite a bit of competition in the marketplace with the NFL, or with, you know, if the NBA wants to finish its season or its playoffs, same for the NHL, if they want to finish things off. You know, we're already starting to see tennis and swimming and some of the easier to execute sports start to come back, you know, in the coming weeks. So I think the baseball has to kind of go above and beyond to make itself interesting and relevant, not to just come back with the same kind of boring, long, stodgy product that it was having trouble selling to young people before this all started. I mean, I think that, you know, as Ben says, baseball has to do everything it can to keep its name in the news and to keep it front and center in front of mind. You know, like that's, like you said, that's why you have winter tours. That's why you have winter fests. That's why we have the All-Star break, really, is to, you know, keep baseball front of mind while giving most of the league a break. You know, I think that's why we've seen a lot of these proposals kind of purposefully leaked out over the last few weeks, is to say, hey, like, baseball's still a thing. We're still trying. Let's get everybody writing about baseball and talking about baseball. I mean, hell, that's why we have the winter meetings, right, guys? Like the GM meetings. Why do we still go through this archaic process? Well, it keeps baseball in the headlines over the winter. So I do think there's some considerations to be made there.
Oh, for sure. I think that's definitely a factor. Although it's funny to hear you say baseball winter meetings, because like there's no chance those are happening, right?
You don't think so, Shai?
How are you going to hold a massive meeting? I mean, like, think about like how many times we've been like scrambling through the lobby, trying to get somewhere, trying to find somebody, and like dodging all the different people. Like, would you want to be locked down with people of varying levels of hygiene in the midst of a pandemic?
That sounds like a lot of baseball coverage, and no, I wouldn't. You know, it's tricky dynamic, but I think, like, to Arden's point, the winter meetings haven't had to happen in person for any of, like, certainly any of the winter meetings that I've covered.
That could have been done on Zoom very easily.
Exactly. You know, you can do it on Zoom. They're all texting each other anyway. Like, no deal. Right. It's not like Ross Atkins is sitting down with Jed Hoyer and just and clapping each other on the back and shaking hands. And like, they're texting each other. So I think you don't need it. I think it's a TV event. I wonder, though. It's possible it could be canceled this year, but I think it will come back roaring by 2021 at the latest.
I'd hope so. Look, I think that all that's contingent on the vaccine. It's an odd time. Like, I think it's going to be interesting to see baseball when it doesn't have the sporting landscape to itself the way that it traditionally does in most of the summers, right? Like, they are going to be going, in all likelihood, up against the NBA for a period and up against the NHL for a period and against the NFL. And look, there could be, the way the other sports go, you know, if the NHL and NBA start up late enough, you know, they could end up pushing back their next seasons. So baseball may get a window of relative exclusivity, but it's not going to be the way that it's been, where, you know, this is summer's game, and, you know, they've got the summer largely to themselves, and off you go. But do you have to change radically and perhaps potentially devalue what the meaning of your championship is to get there? I'm not sure. I mean, I love the idea of some sort of postseason tournament as a one-off, just seeing how it goes, especially if you're playing a shortened season, because you're not really separating the cream from the crop of the rest of the way 162 games really does. You have to be an amazing team to survive 162 games, but you can fluke your way through 80, maybe even through 100. And so if you're not going to have a true regular season where, you know, a team separates itself, then maybe you don't have to have a true postseason in that environment. But, you know, if you're going to count them as a World Series winner and give them the Commissioner's Trophy all the same, you know, I'm not sure that if you go too far down the road, whether, you know, you devalue it at least for the season and maybe turned off some people in the process.
We shall see. We shall see. Shai, thank you so much for taking the time today. All the best. And we'll be talking to you soon.
My pleasure as always, boys. Stay healthy, and hopefully we can get together over a non-virtual format in the near future.
Our thanks to colleague and friend Shai Davidi for joining us this week. You can get him on Twitter at Shai Davidi. Obviously, read him at sportsnet.ca. That is also where you can read myself, Arden Zwelling, and Ben Nicholson-Smith. We are at Arden Zwelling and at B. Nicholson-Smith on Twitter. Special thanks to our producer, Christian Ryan, at Christian Ryan NS on Twitter. Give him a follow. Thanks to him for all of his hard work. And thanks to all of you for listening. Talk to you next week on At the Letters.